Welcome to Focus on the Upstate, a program dedicated to informing you about organizations that serve our community and how you can get involved with them. Here's your host, Chris Evans.
Good morning and welcome to Focus on the Upstate, a pre-recorded production of Entercom Communications. My name is Chris Evans, and today my guest is Dr. Robin LaCroix, the Medical Director and Chair of the Pediatrics Department at Prisma Health's Children's Hospital. Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. And I want to take an opportunity because if I'm not mistaken, this is episode 14 of the COVID Chronicles, but it's the first one that you've been on. So welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. I'm going to start with a question that I usually ask a new guest, which is what do you do and who do you do it for? Just take a minute to introduce yourself to the audience.
Sure. As you mentioned, I'm chairman of the Department of Pediatrics and medical director of Children's Hospital here at Prisma Health Children's Hospital of the Upstate. My specialty is in pediatric infectious disease, so I spend my professional clinical time taking care of children with all types of infections.
So you're exactly who we should be talking to on the COVID Chronicles.
I certainly take care of a lot of children with infections, so I am happy to speak into both how coronavirus has affected children, but also our community as a whole.
You know, not to get too far off topic of COVID-19 and the coronavirus pandemic that's going on, but one of the things that Entercom is known for is our radiothon to benefit Children's Hospital, Prisma Health Children's Hospital. And I'm curious, since I've got you on the phone, as far as infectious diseases are concerned, what are the primary concerns, maybe outside of COVID-19, because we're going to talk about that later, but what are the primary concerns in general for infectious diseases with children?
So clearly, there are a couple avenues, and one is the vaccine-preventable diseases, and we all have had a lot of concern around the impact that COVID and people not seeking preventative services have caused children to get behind on their immunization, mm-hmm. and that subsequently opens these children to become susceptible to other infectious diseases like measles and pertussis and pneumococcal meningitis and a number of other diseases that we have done a really nice job with preventing by having children fully vaccinated.
Well, let's talk about vaccines for a second, because there's been a lot of talk about a COVID-19 vaccine. We don't have one yet, but I know that there are a lot of scientists working very hard on developing one, and that's supposed to be a major milestone in this pandemic in terms of treatment and prevention. And I've kind of wondered, I talked a while ago, it was probably close to 2 months ago now, with your colleague, Dr. Carrie Cease, and learned from her that chickenpox is one of the things that we vaccinate for now. I got chickenpox when I was a little kid, but I understand that it is largely a preventable disease now that we have a vaccine for it to treat children with.
Right. Varicella, which is the chickenpox vaccine, is incorporated into the schedule. So cases of varicella now are very, very uncommon because the children have vaccine-protected immunity and aren't able to readily spread it. And both measles, which we've as a country experienced and the upstate experienced an outbreak several years ago, is another very, very vaccine preventable condition. And so the idea around taking a novel virus for which nobody has immunity and developing a vaccine, our most recent experience with this was with H1N1 influenza, which several years ago emerged as a completely novel. No one in the country had antibodies or an ability to not become infected with this. And the vaccine industry was able to produce an effective vaccine that has helped change the face and the number of infections with influenza H1N1.
Well, and actually, I'm going to ask you to speculate. What sort of form would a COVID-19 vaccine take? I imagine if people have children and they're maybe holding off on getting their kids vaccinated because they're expecting this COVID-19 vaccine to come out in a few months or maybe even within a year, is it going to be something that is fairly long-term, like the measles, mumps, rubella, varicella, you know, all of those vaccines where you take them once and you're effectively protected? I don't know that they actually last forever. Maybe you can elaborate on that. But they're long-term. They're not like the flu shot, which you have to get every single year.
Right. So those are the types of pieces of science that are not well understood. So I think two parts of the question. One is, don't delay on the well-established vaccines that are a part of the recommended group of vaccines. Don't delay on those. Make sure your children are completely protected. As the virus for the coronavirus vaccine is developed and released, remember that the information that we know about the long-term protection around some of the vaccines like varicella and like pertussis and measles vaccines took a number of years of following those recipients to understand the length of protection. So early on, we are not going to be able to speak into how long will the protection from this last, and will it be a situation like influenza where we believe that you have vaccine protection for about 180 days, and then that's the reason that as those vaccine protective antibodies, we call it decay away, become less potent and in lower concentrations, that you get a new vaccine. The other reason you get another flu vaccine is that...
Well, the strains are frequently changing,
is that
right?
We know, yes. The strains change, they shift, they drift, and so the vaccine manufacturers follow this and look back at, you know, right now it's winter in the southern hemisphere, and you can understand what strains are circulating in order to develop the vaccine. I think that influenza vaccine uptake this fall and this winter is going to be incredibly important because COVID-19 symptomatology is very, very similar to influenza. And people that I have cared for who have had this describe themselves as feeling as if they have had the flu. And so as we attempt to do everything we can to protect our health and the health of our family members and our coworkers, receiving the seasonal influenza means that you have less likelihood of bringing that particular viral infection into your home or your workplace.
Well, and with COVID-19, we so far only have the one strain of it. So if we can develop a vaccine for that, then it will be presumably specific to that particular variety of coronavirus. Do you think it's likely that a COVID-19 vaccine will ever be incorporated into the flu vaccine as just a sort of shotgun approach to preventing a variety of diseases, or will we have to get a separate flu shot and a separate COVID-19 shot?
Yeah, so it's very complicated to put multiple antigens into a single vaccine. It's the reason that it took so many years for us to develop pediatric vaccines that had multiple different antigens in them and be sure that we could get the same response. Mm-hmm. So I think that it would be a number of years and a good bit of science behind that to assure that you get the same efficacy as you might get having each individual.
I know that with the advent of the pandemic, there were a lot of supplies, not just medical supplies, the PPE, the personal protective equipment that you guys use constantly in the course of your job, but also things like meat and toilet paper and you know, household cleaning supplies were in short supply. Do people need to check with their pediatrician to make sure that these vaccines are available for their kids, the regular scheduled vaccines are available? Has there been any shortage of that kind of stuff?
Thankfully, we have not had shortage of the vaccines, and partially because the vaccine manufacturers and the system of supply that involves both a private sector and a government sector have been able to continue with production through this. So vaccine shortage, thankfully, is not one of the things that we've had to deal with. Fortunately, we've been able to change over. As everybody knows, you can't buy a Clorox wipe in the grocery store or any of the big box stores. And we were able to, with our compounding pharmacy, basically create the very same solution that we're able to bring into our practices. So their practices have been able to continue to have all of the appropriate disinfectants that they needed readily accessible.
That's a very clever solution.
It's much as has happened with some of the distilleries turning over to produce hand gel.
Yeah. We talked a little bit about making sure that your kids get their vaccinations, and I wonder if another reason that people might not be doing that is just because of all of we're starting to open back up. For a while, we were under this sort of shutdown order where people were working from home, school was canceled. I mean, there was a lot of stuff that got closed because we were worried about this epidemic. And now that things are opening back up, I wonder if people are still concerned about going to the doctor because that's where sick people are. You still need to take their kids for their wellness checks.
Right. Yes, absolutely. And some of the things that we have done with our Prisma Health practices is to look at having people register ahead of time, check in ahead of time using the MyChart connection, and then they're able to keep their children with them in their automobile and then get notified to come in. Sick children and well children are being segregated within the practice so that we avoid mixing. We've taken waiting rooms and removed chairs. We've encouraged folks to not use waiting rooms at all, but sometimes there are instances where people do need to come into the waiting room as the temperature increases. So we've spent a lot of time looking at our environment and how we are able to keep people socially distanced and to segregate sick and well from each other, even dividing buildings so that pods are dedicated to one type of care versus the other. That plus the fact that all of our employees have their temperature checked and are masked the entire time that they're in their working environment, and the patients get their temperature checked at the door as well as masked. Everybody who's 2 and older has a mask. The younger babies and their carriers are often just covered with their parents' blanket. So the opportunity for respiratory spread is diminished. And then a huge focus on cleaning the environment. We have people assigned who on time schedules are out taking care of their environment, the high-touch surfaces, the doorknobs, the flat surfaces that someone might have had hand contact with. So I think the idea of focusing on how can we very safely get these children in, the vaccine schedules are set based on the science behind the vaccine, and so there's a true time interval. And as we move farther into this, we have some children who are now almost 2 vaccine cycles behind, and so the catch-up on them leaves us always running a few months behind those children being fully immunized. Certainly, as decisions around school and with the requirements for daycare, making sure that those children are fully immunized. Hepatitis A has been added in to some of the required immunizations, and so making sure that we're able to get everybody fully immunized and ready to go for either school or in the daycare environment.
We were talking about kind of reopening, and that it sounds like the preventative measures that we've been taking so far, the hand washing and the social distancing and the wearing of masks and cleaning surfaces and things like that, are things that we still need to be doing even as we go back to our kind of regular lives. But I know that you wanted to talk about the reopening of childcare facilities, and that now as things are opening back up, people might be sending their kids back to daycare or things like that, and that there may be some risks involved with that that people need to be aware of.
I do think that parents certainly can reach out to their child care situation. CDC has given some good guidance around this. DHEC has given some good guidance. DHEC has provided the healthcare, the child care facilities with alternative cleaning solutions that are with available things like diluted bleach solutions and things like that are very, very effective at eliminating the virus. And I think that parents reaching out to their child care provider and asking questions like, what do you have in place? Are your caregivers masked? What is the hand hygiene availability and opportunity? What are you doing with the environment? So much around children is very high touch. So how do we remove things that are difficult to clean, like soft toys and other objects that are multi-use, like crayons? Can kids have, instead of a big box of crayons that they pull from to work with, can they have their individual boxes? how are we handling hand hygiene with the children before snacks and eating? How are we handling hand hygiene around tissues and other areas that we know may have higher content of virus? And really understanding what changes are being made within their child care setting to further protect their children, because as the community prevalence increases, we know that we will have more healthcare workers, we'll have more child care workers, we'll have more employees who are in the public space infected with the virus, and that us looking at how do we continue to protect these people often are asymptomatic, and we are discovering this more and more as we enhance testing, are very mildly symptomatic. They may feel like they're simply having some trouble with allergy and yet actually have a mildly symptomatic case of COVID-19. And so as we see more of this in the community, how do we look at protecting those folks who are with this group? We're protecting each other as we look into doing the things that we know are public health measures. If I can take the liberty, you know, I think Linda Bell, who is the state epidemiologist for South Carolina, who was urging people to wear a mask in public and to continue to social distance, just had a very impactful quote. And she said, "The virus does not spread on its own. It's spread around our state by infected people who carry it wherever they go. Their work, the supermarket, the post office, or even a friend's house. By not following public health precautions, many are putting all at risk." And, you know, I think that everybody's very exhausted from being isolated and from following this and from putting a mask on and from continually worrying about what are you touching and do I have something with me that I can clean my hands with, or can I even find some hand gel to get my hands clean. Yeah, I think everybody is very fatigued, but it is not time for us to stop. And if anything, when we see the kind of numbers that we saw yesterday with 987 new cases, the highest case, daily case rise that we have seen in our state, that we have to sort of get our second wind and really dive into continuing to hold each other accountable and to set the example for others that we are going to be responsible and we're going to wear a mask and we're going to be doing hand hygiene and practicing social distancing and avoiding congregate settings, and that we are really stepping into this because it's not only for our own health, but it's also for the health of our community.
Well, and the increased testing and the increased number of cases that we're seeing is something that I wanted to ask about. Early on, when this pandemic was really still burgeoning and getting going back in March, people were admonished not to get tested unless they had symptoms because, as we mentioned, the supplies were very short, and testing people who didn't show any symptoms could be considered a waste of them. Now we've got more supplies, and most of the people who are symptomatic have been tested already. So we're starting to test people who are not really showing obvious symptoms. Is that the case with this increased testing?
So I think it's twofold. So correct, we are in a much better position in terms of supplies and testing reagent and testing capability. And that's been part of the outreach that's happened with the community testing sites, so that we are able to go to communities and where people may not have had access to be able to reach out for testing or had minor symptoms that they thought, this is probably not so bad, I probably don't need to go. There was a lot of fear for re-entering the healthcare system that you were going to become exposed. So if you just had a cold or an allergy, you might catch something worse. So the community testing sites opened that up, and they do a screening, and certainly it is a fairly long list, about 9 different items that people are screened with. And the other piece that has become much more important is the contact tracing. So as there's more disease, the number of people that we're testing who have been exposed to a known true case with a significant exposure, and that's where the contact tracing helps us understand that. Those folks, we need to understand what their status is so that they are not potentially transmitting to the next group of people.
So with this increased testing, as you mentioned, we've seen a kind of a large number of new cases, but the hospitalization rate and the death rate is holding fairly steady even after several weeks of increased testing. Is it just that we're finding more people that don't have as severe cases? I guess we're getting a bigger picture of the extent of the pandemic rather than just the most severe cases.
Right. And there are really two pieces to that. One is we are identifying more cases, but as we look at the percentage of people that we test, the percentage of people who are positive is increasing. And so what that signals is that there is a greater disease burden within the community. And so what we are now experiencing is there are the group of people who are completely asymptomatic, there are a group of people who are mildly symptomatic, don't require hospitalization, and then there is the group that become significantly affected by the infection and subsequently are requiring hospitalization. So the hospitalization numbers will continue to rise. We have a number of different modalities now for actual intervention for the virus, both antivirals plus some of the plasma therapies that are available, plus what we call supportive care, meaning helping people make sure that their oxygen saturations and that some of the other conditions that accompany infection with the virus are addressed and proactively taken care of. So those things we hope will continue to allow us to have a flat death curve, because obviously having people recover from this is the primary goal. So I think that things are happening now in a more accelerated rate because there are more people in the community who are infected, and therefore their ability to infect others in the community becomes more exponential. If one person infects, statistics say, between 2 to 3 other people, then when there are more people there potentially spreading the virus, we see those numbers rise more rapidly.
Dr. LaCroix, one of the things that I wanted to ask you before we run out of time here, DHEC recently started reporting probable cases of COVID-19 in addition to confirmed cases of COVID-19, and they've released some documentation about this. A confirmed case, I think, is fairly self-explanatory. Basically, it's a case that has been confirmed by a viral test. They've actually tested this person for the virus itself, not for antibodies or anything like that, but for the virus itself, and it's come back positive, and that's a confirmed case. They're also now talking about probable cases, and that's generated some confusion among people with exactly what a probable case means. DHEC has described that as a case that has epidemiologic evidence and clinical evidence of infection. Can you describe what those things mean for us in layman terms that didn't go to medical school?
Sure. So the epidemiologic link is that you were in close contact or exposed to a truly diagnosed infected person. And then the clinical presentation, you then become ill and you have pneumonia that has the classic findings of a viral lung infection. Even if your test were negative, we believe that clinically you have signs and symptoms that are consistent with this viral infection, and we know that you were exposed, then that is the probable definition.
So epidemiologic really has more to do with the social interaction. People haven't been doing the social distancing properly, and that they have come into contact, that contact tracing that you mentioned earlier, with people who have been confirmed to have the virus. And then clinical evidence, I guess, is actually a test like those other tests that we talked about, antibody testing or something like that, that have been determined to be a little less reliable than the PCR testing that they used to find the actual virus in somebody. Is that right?
Right. So the antibody testing, antibodies are what your body make in response to the infection.
Right.
And we're still learning about these antibody tests because, remember, these were all developed within the last 6 months. So there's not a long history with them in understanding how sensitive, how likely are they to give you the correct answer is part of what we're learning. So we know that there are people who will have a positive antibody test and yet may not have been very ill. Conversely, we know people who have had positive tests who will have negative antibody tests.
Well, and the CDC actually says in this documentation, a positive antibody test alone is currently not a reliable method for diagnosing a COVID-19 infection.
And that is true because there are a number of other coronaviruses that circulate like a regular cold. These relatives of the COVID-19 are less invasive and certainly less significant disease causing. They typically cause sort of cold congestion type symptoms. So there is the concern about cross-reactivity. So if you had a cold with one of the other varieties of coronavirus and you have antibodies, we are still not completely certain that the antibody that we measured is the COVID-19. And that's the reason that the CDC has said until we learn more about this testing and about how reliable it is, we still want people to take into context the limitations of the test.
Dr. LaCroix, we have run out of time here, and I just want to remind people of some websites that they can find more information. PrismaHealth.org/coronavirus has a bunch of information about how Prisma Health is addressing the coronavirus pandemic here in the upstate and across the state. Also, PrismaHealth.org/access is where you can find out more information about telemedicine and virtual visits, even download the Prisma Health Go app and set those kinds of things up. And of course, 1063WORD.com is where you can find more news about coronavirus that is not necessarily related to Prisma and the specific measures that they're taking, but is generally more news-oriented. Dr. Robin LaCroix, the medical director and chair of the pediatrics department at Prisma Health Children's Hospital here in the upstate, has been my guest today. Thank you again, doctor, for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you for the opportunity.
Well, it's been my pleasure. I'm Chris Evans, and this has been Focus on the Upstate.
You've been listening to Focus on the Upstate with Chris Evans. If you would like more information on today's topic, email Chris at cevans@intercom.com.